Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Our guest today is Jack Gedney. Jack is the author of Private Life of Birds, Learning to Listen to the Birds Where We Live, and A Compact Field Guide to the Trees of the San Francisco Bay Area. Since 2018, he has written a column on local birds called On the Wing for the Marin Independent Journal, and Jack currently co-owns a wild bird feeding and nature shop in Novato, California. Our focus today is Jack's new book, The Birds in the Oaks, Secret Voices of the Western Woods, which his wife Angelina beautifully illustrated. Here's a description of the book. This is the first book on the birds of the California oaks from our most lyrical and observant wanderer of the woods. With charm and delight, The Birds in the Oaks introduces us to birds who burrow, forage, and soar among California's keystone trees. The mighty oak hosts a multitude of avian denizens, from canopy hoppers to ground nesters to short-billed surface pluckers, who rely on the tree's well-stocked pantry of acorns, insects, and flowers for sustenance and shelter. Spunky kinglets, crimson-eyed towhees, cuddle-craving bush tits, intrepid nuthatches, and impudent wrens are among the many memorable cast members in this pageant of oak-allied birds. Jack Gedney lyrically conveys the beautiful and comic and endearing qualities of over 15 bird species, each profile paired with an illustration by Angelina Gedney. His bird-filled tales of adaptation, ingenuity, and sheer persistence also bring light to the warp and weft of cross-species interdependence. The Bird in the Oaks reveals to us the utter joy of birds, the superabundant world of oaks, and the innumerable interconnections these living beings create. This was a wonderful conversation. I love talking to Jack. He's such a calming presence. And this was a fascinating conversation looking at our natural landscape here in California and how it all intersects. Let's go meet Jack. So to start, Jack, what interests you about the life of birds?
There's a lot of different ways of answering that question, depending on different people come from different perspectives. For me, the special thing about birds is that they are so ubiquitous and common in all of our lives. Where a lot of bird writers have perspectives of formal qualifications or being ornithologists or science writers, mine was the specific entryway of backyard bird feeding, where my day job is I own a bird feeding and nature shop. And so the kind of context in which I started talking about birds with so many people was in terms of the birds that they see all around them every day and realizing how ubiquitous that is and how the potential for enriching our lives through recognizing and appreciating these creatures that are all around us every day is the great opportunity of birds to enrich everyone's life.
Yeah. Let's imagine that you could be a bird for a day and just see through their eyes. What kind of different knowledge do you think you'd acquire if you were to inhabit a bird's kind of senses for a while?
Of course, there's a great deal of diversity within birds, and I try and do that experiment with different species and get a very different answer if you're looking at life from a perspective of a red-tailed hawk rather than a California towhee. But I think you would, in the same way have that I'm trying to do in general, would be true on a specific level of having a much more vivid sense of the natural phenomena of life, and sometimes on a very sensory level in terms of right now we're so many people are insulated from a physical experience. There's some great books by David Abram, like The Spell of the Sensuous and Becoming Animal, where he really tries to make vivid just our basic sensory experience of feeling things again, where so many people experience life through screens and through abstractions. So birds don't have that. They experience hot and cold and danger and safety, being hungry, being satisfied, in a way that's much more vivid. And of course, that can be translated into a million more specific ways of knowing the hiding spots in a given habitat, of knowing where you're drawn to, what elements of that environment are sources of food, sources of safety.
So, if you were to describe the landscape for people of birding, like as it is today, you have a lot of different varieties, more casual, more serious birders. Then you have people that collect and almost gamified, where you're trying to get them all, or you're trying to find
Absolutely.
catch everyone either through photography or through your site. Like, how would you describe the world of birding as it stands right now?
Yeah, as you're describing it perfectly accurately, that there is a diversity of approaches out there, and there is a world of competitive birding, which is not primarily my world, though I certainly come in contact with it. But a lot of people do think of birding that way, as a quest to add more birds to your life list, or in many cases, a country list, a county list, sometimes a yard list. And that exists, but exists alongside much more common experience in the whole scope of the human population of people just enjoying and appreciating the birds they see on their hikes at the local park or in their own yard and neighborhood. And that's the kind of birding world that I'm most at home in and most passionate about encouraging.
So casual as opposed to more systematic. Is there downsides to that competitive side, that systematizing side of birding?
I think potentially, yeah, it can turn the adding of something else to your list into the objective rather than the experience itself of spending time observing birds. And it rewards a general feeling of valuing novelty too much. I remember something I read back in college days from Arne Naess, the deep ecology philosopher, where one of his principles was to discourage neophilia, the love of the new. And I think that could apply in lots of philosophical senses to the modern world, and it can apply to birding as well, where the niche that I try to explore in my books is the opposite of that, is not about accumulating species, not about accumulating novel experiences, but becoming more familiar with the limited number of species with which we come in contact every day.
Something I noticed in both of your books is the importance of indigenous thought. Some of my favorite books, like Tending the Wild, looking at nature through indigenous lens. What do you think the value is? Let's say you're talking to somebody who's a more kind of modern scientific kind of taxonomy mindset, 21st century Western science. What's to be gained from using indigenous thought to look at the landscape, if you will?
Yeah, great question. So it's not my area of expertise, but I did try to draw on it whenever it was accessible to me for these specific species in both books. And from my perspective, it's one facet of a broader attempt to integrate cultural history with scientific natural history. And that can take many forms, of which indigenous knowledge is one major example, but all of them revolve around thinking about how people in the past have related to these birds. While modern science, narrowly understood, is thought of as objective, as the attempt to gather information and test hypotheses about birds and how they live without the lens of how does this relate to people, whether in an economic sense or an aesthetic sense or any kind of human-based lens. And that certainly has a lot of value, that objective scientific inquiry. But for example, some of the native voices will integrate bird figures in mythology, where you'll have figures like a falcon in many different cultures. That can be peregrine or prairie falcons in various native tribes of California. And what they appreciate about this bird is, in some sense, something very simple in the form that it comes down to us today, of a sense of speed and power and broad-ranging ability to travel. And it's captured in the form of story in a way that is more vivid and memorable. And we get the same thing when I look at other forms of cultural history, where I look at folk names or I look at old-time bird writers from the 1800s, early 1900s, who allowed more elements of anthropomorphism sometimes, but also forms of bias and interest that, while departing from scientific objectivity, are very valuable for my purpose, for our everyday human beings' purpose of enriching our own lives with birds. And since that is my goal rather than expanding the frontiers of ornithological science, understanding how other people have related to birds and found their traits and qualities of individual species to be meaningful and express that in the most memorable and vivid ways possible. That is, I think, hugely valuable for that project.
I loved how literary your book was. I love the kind of integration of fiction, poetry throughout. Which writer that maybe you wouldn't have expected had some really beautiful and poignant thoughts about birds? What was one that just jumps out to you that you included in your work?
Many of the more literary touches were old-time ornithologists or people who would be classed in some sense as nature poets, people like Gary Snyder, Robert Haase. And I think in this book,
We can circle back to that question. We can move on. Let's move on to the next one. Who writing today do you get excited when they have a new book out about flora, fauna, anything nature related? Who for you are some of the leading lights that we should look to? And if you have some in mind that it's about the West specifically, that would be great. But who do you look to when you're looking at book releases and you're like, oh, another one?
Interesting question. In many respects, my touchstones for my nature writing are extremely old-fashioned. Many readers of my books will note where the authors that I'm most excited when I obtain a new book is, oh, someone just dropped off a bird book from the 1890s here. To be honest, I don't actually keep up with modern nature writing to a high degree. There's some authors that I dip into and certainly find helpful. I'd include Bernd Heinrich in that category, who is a relative rarity of someone who conducts actual ornithological research but integrates it with a lot of personal observation in a way that makes it more personally relevant and valuable to people. I would say another modern nature book that I appreciate a lot, which is not on the literary side, is an entry in the Peterson Field Guide series to Bird Sounds of Western North America by Nathan Peeplow, Pieplow, I believe, where there certainly is still valuable work being done on what seems like a more dry and factual level. But that is perhaps my favorite modern bird book, is this encyclopedia of bird sounds, where paying attention to very basic phenomena of cataloging the different vocalizations of birds, and in a way that is designed to make it easier for us to recognize them, is extremely valuable for increasing your convivial relations with your local birds.
Let's go ahead and jump into the meat of your book. I want to start with oak trees from California. Grew up in California. Oak trees have been part of my whole life. I had a beautiful oak tree in my neighborhood growing up that I would sit under. How different are the species? Like, how different is a valley oak from a coastal oak?
Quite different. There are some broad similarities, of course. So oak trees are a hugely important genus, not just in California, worldwide. They're the most successful tree by some measures. And they all share some important features. Most notably and familiarly to people, they have acorns, the hard nuts with a cap. That's an important food source for many birds and other organisms. But there are substantial differences. We've got, I believe, 18 different species of oak in California, of which about half commonly grows as trees and half as shrubs. The two species you mentioned, the valley oak compared to a live oak, whether that's a coast live oak or interior live oak, it's the biggest distinction that people should make if they're starting to get to grips with their oaks. Live oaks are evergreen, well, as opposed to the other deciduous oaks, such as valley oak, blue oak, black oak. So you will find sometimes relatively subtle differences. For instance, that's one I explore in the chapter on the nuthatch, which favors in California the deciduous oak species, many of which have this deeply ridged bark on, say, a valley oak or blue oak, while that of live oaks is relatively smooth. And something that seemingly innocuous little fact about a tree from a human perspective can be very influential on a bird's distribution, in that those deep ridges are hiding places for both arthropod prey, in case they're nuthatch, and also gives them places to cache food, to store seeds or nut fragments out of reach of shorter-billed birds.
And you've gestured to this, but let's unpack it a little bit more. Oaks are often referred to as keystone species, where they're these central species in an ecosystem. Why are oaks so important to so much life in California?
So oaks are, as I said, extremely numerous and abundant, and that is in itself a starting point. So the first level would be just that they're the most abundant trees in many
And they
habitats.
live a long time, right? I didn't realize how long they lived. It's incredible.
So several hundred years is totally possible for many of our oak species. And so on a first, most basic level, birds use trees for all kinds of purposes. For they'll fly into trees to avoid predators, to place their nests to avoid predators. They'll eat directly parts of trees, and they'll eat insects that dwell in trees. And so first, just by virtue of their abundance, oaks are the most prominent trees in many of California's environments. And then related to that is there's this a thesis that I think goes is now quite well established, that by virtue of being the most abundant tree species, they then come to be the host species for more and more insects and other arthropods. Where there's a classic study from several decades ago where scientists looked at the English oak, and they like shook them out, tried to count all the insect species dwelling on it, came up with, I think, hundreds of species. And then they did the same for common ornamental trees and got dozens rather than hundreds. And the same thing is true in California, where there's over 800 different arthropod species recorded living on California oaks. Because they're so abundant over evolutionary time, more and more creatures adapt to eat them and to dwell on them. And so that increases the opportunities for birds. Both have themselves the ability to directly feed on them. That's through acorns most prominently, but potentially through new leaf growth or through flowers, but also in many cases eating the insects or other plants that parasitize or live on oaks in various ways.
And I know that there's been some stresses on oak trees from climate change. What would be the impact if oaks couldn't survive in our climate? What would it do to our ecosystem?
It would be huge impact in ways that I don't think we fully understand, and it does vary by species. In some cases, it's very straightforward, where there are many bird species that are extremely dependent in California on oak trees, things like acorn woodpeckers, California scrub jay, oak titmouse, essentially don't occur in California in habitats that are devoid of oaks. The cascading impacts for many other organisms would be harder to predict, and we're seeing it in different habitats. Most prominently in the near term, probably sudden oak death, which has removed essentially tan oaks from many mixed forests and is in the process of doing so with coast live oaks in certain habitats. And what you get is a forest with less diversity of trees, and then we'll follow in the train of that, less diversity of arthropods and in many cases of birds as well.
Okay, let's jump into talking about birds. There are so many sections in your book that I loved so much and were thought experiments for me a little bit. Let's talk about bird songs. I found this very fascinating. What can we learn about the life of a bird from the song that it sings?
Yeah, so a little kind of general stage setting on bird song. Song is performed by birds mostly in the nesting season and mostly by males, for a couple purposes. The main one being to declare territory. Most songbirds are seasonally monogamous. They like to exclude other males from access to their female or to the other resources of the territory. And often, in many cases, for purposes of mate attraction. And the degree to which song is important for will vary from species to species for mate attraction. So you can see in species that have more complex, elaborate songs, on average, will be more useful as a marker of cognitive health and of general overall physical vitality. So you think of something like a mockingbird would be the classic example, but could also include other birds, like a lesser goldfinch would be a great one. That's a classic California species, where they have these elaborate songs that contain dozens and sometimes hundreds of different elements, many of them imitations of other birds, that what they're demonstrating is a health and vigor that is appealing to females. While if you have other birds that have extremely simple songs, that don't successfully fulfill that function, but are primarily emphasizing the territorial declaration aspect. And that you'll see more in species such as oak titmouse or spotted towhee. Don't have that same cycle of needing to use the song for mate attraction in the same way. So that it does tie in the differences in song to different overall life histories.
Okay. How hard is it to learn to distinguish different bird songs and calls? It seems really complicated. Is that what's the learning curve for that? Is it just a lot of repetition of listening to sounds and starting to recognize patterns, or how did you learn?
It's easier now than it has ever been in the history of humanity in many ways. We have a lot of great tools now, but the fundamentals are not difficult. And I can recommend some resources, but for me, it was fairly simple. The main things you want are a good source of recordings that are representative. The best one for that is probably the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, which is the great institution of democratizing bird education today. And they have either through their website, All About Birds, or through their free app called Merlin, they have a well-curated library of representative recordings. And then the key for humans to learn those sounds and make it into something memorable is to put it into words in some form, to have some sort of description that our brains can process more naturally than abstract sounds. So Cornell on their website will have descriptions, or most decent field guides will have descriptions. So you just want to find the vocalization of a bird that's common that you encounter regularly, play the sound, and read the description along with it, whether it is a description using musical terminologies, like something is an accelerating trill, it's high pitched, or whether it's some kind of analogy or mnemonic, like some people hear California quail is saying, Chicago, where are you? Where are you? And those kind of patterns make it much more memorable. Limit yourself at first to the common birds that you encounter regularly, and just add one vocalization at a time. Find what you're hearing and play it, and find a way to describe it that is comprehensible and memorable to you.
I loved a lot of the birds you talk about in your book and grew up seeing a lot of them. I think my favorite to watch is a nuthatch, this kind of upside down, I don't know, rappelling or climbing. How would you describe? Can you describe what it is they're doing and why they're doing that?
In the birds and the oaks, the main nuthatch species I talk about is the white-breasted nuthatch, which is our oak specialist nuthatch in California. We also have red-breasted and pygmy nuthatches. So their classic motion is to go down trees head first, though they can go in either direction. And this is in contrast to most other bark-clinging birds. So woodpeckers or brown creepers go primarily in an upwards orientation due to the architecture of their feet and overall body structure. Nuthatches, though, the theory is that they go down head first for a few advantages. One is that they might find things in those ridges of the bark that other birds miss. They're hunting. They have a mixed diet of seeds and invertebrates. So they're hunting for insects, for spiders, for beetles, for a variety of different creatures that are hiding in those crevices. But then also, nuthatches store food. So this could be acorn bits, could be seeds that they will deposit in there. They have very long beaks, are twice as long as that of a titmouse or a chickadee, comparable to that of some of the much larger woodpecker species. And they can insert things down into these crevices. And by going downwards, they are successfully avoiding minimizing visibility to birds that only travel in an upwards direction by having that different direction of approach.
Ah, that's fascinating. That's so wild. Another thing I found fascinating and was a great tool for thinking about was feeding guilds. We break down birds into categories. I think that's a useful concept for people to understand. So you can explain that.
Yeah, so the idea of feeding guilds is that many birds can be understood as a convenient shorthand, not a perfect system, in terms of how they feed. I say at one point that watching birds is in many cases watching birds eat, and that is their main activity of the day that is visible to us. For instance, some birds are ground scratchers. Some birds are probers on the in the bark crevices. Some birds are gleaners off the surface of the bark. Some birds glean insects off the surface of the foliage. Some birds chisel into dead or rotting wood, like woodpeckers, to access creatures inside. Some birds are fly-catching species that specialize in grabbing insects out of the air. And so when you start recognizing these different categories, it's both a way of sorting out the birds in your mind, just one way to put them in categories to help you make sense of what are the different species present in an area, so it's not just one sorted list, but also helps you start seeing the more subtle differences within the guilds, where when you realize that, okay, there's kinglets and there's vireos and there's chickadees and there's titmice, and all of them are doing some surface gleaning of small insects, then you can start asking what are the subtler differences that influence one bird's distribution being slightly different than that of another.
I love the chapter about chickadees and breaking chickadee down into component parts. It almost felt, and you described it as like toddlers trying to listen to a bunch of toddlers talking to each other. Is the chickadee, is it like binary or something, like where you can like compound the different sounds to make different meanings? Like, I'm still not fully grasping like the chickadee language. Can you explain that?
I don't think we've fully grasped the chickadee
Yeah, to the
language.
best of your understanding.
Yeah. So what's unique about the name chickadee is an onomatopoeic name, and the chickadees will give a vocalization that sounds like that, but they those syllables represented by chickadee occur in precisely that order, but can be repeated. So you can have chickadee or chickadee, but you wouldn't have d chick. So this is still, I think, relatively in early stages of understanding, and there may be variations between different species of chickadee. More research has been done on black-capped chickadees, which are the common chickadee in the East and across much of the country, than in our local species, the chestnut-backed chickadee that I focus on. But it does seem that, for instance, when they do experiments, there was one that I cite where researchers had decoy of a large owl species, I think it was a great gray owl, and then a decoy of a smaller owl species that was more of a threat to chickadees, and they had a different reliably repeated pattern of in terms of how many repeated D's there were in their chickadee. So it does seem that they use it for specific communicative functions, that is some kind of language based on how many times specific syllables are repeated in a way that is somewhat analogous to human language of combining different elements and different quantities to express specific different meanings.
Let's say you're hiking in the Sierra Nevadas. What would be a bird you would be excited to see?
Sure. So some birds I'd be excited to see in the Sierras would be a northern goshawk, or a little more commonly, hill-eated woodpecker. This book in particular is one that's aimed at relatively lowland California.
Yeah,
So
I live in the Central Valley. What should I be excited to see?
Central Valley, I'd say magpies would be one that unfortunately didn't make it into the book. It's a specialty of Central Valley. The yellow-billed magpie is an endemic to Central Valley, California, found nowhere else in the world, and a bird that is present in oak woodlands that fortunately coastal Californians even won't really get to see. But they're a large corvid relative to jays and crows, but one that most of the world doesn't get the privilege of knowing.
Okay, let's jump to illustrations. Your partner did some amazing illustrations in the book, and there's been a long history of scientific illustrations and a lot of different styles, from the more kind of, I guess you would call it accurate scientific, to more illustrative, using a style that would be called maybe storytelling through illustrations. How would you describe what she is doing in this book with her illustrations?
Yeah, thanks, Jordan. Somewhere in between, perhaps. So yeah, I was very glad and fortunate that I was able to collaborate with my wife Angelina on the drawings. And we aimed for certainly realism. You want to be able to reliably recognize and identify the birds based on the field marks that one would actually see. But in contrast to many field guides where the kind of ideal of objectivity would be to show every bird in an identically neutral pose and position for easy comparison, We did want to do something more than that, which was to capture an element of the story as presented in the text of the book.
Yeah,
So,
that's what my second question was going to be, is like, what's lost if you go out there with your DSLR camera and you just take pictures of each of the birds and just slap them on the front of each chapter? What does the reader lose in that?
yeah, a couple things potentially. On one side, photos are often by traditionally minded birders thought to be often inferior to a good illustration for purposes of identification, where if you want to make sure that you capture certain field marks in a way that's representative of how you normally see a bird, a photograph can often be misleading. That'll show a bird in a weird position that conceals their normal, most characteristic form, or certain aspects of their plumage might not be visible. But the more on the level of story and narrative, where what I try and do in the written accounts is pull out some aspects of the bird's life history that is resonant and memorable to people. And with the illustrations, we tried to echo and capture some of those same stories, where in titmice, they talk about their lifelong pair bonds. And so we show a pair of titmice in the case of acorn woodpeckers that guard these communal granary trees storing acorns. We have them, an acorn woodpecker at its granary, or a wren is depicted in a tangle of branches while a violet green swallow is shown in the sky. And so my hope is that people will be able to flip back after reading the chapters and see the picture and have those stories instantly come to mind and be evoked by the drawing in a way that is quick and efficient, but also memorable and sticks with them.
Where I work, the art and science department are right next to each other, but they rarely collaborate. What would be your kind of elevator pitch why they should work together?
Art is a great way of conveying why people should care about and be interested in the findings of science, where science can easily become insular and concerned with advancing within its own boundaries of study, but is not necessarily or always focused on communicating the value of that work. And art is what communicates the meaning, the relevance on a human level of all that. On the other hand, scientific knowledge is essential for accurately depicting things, especially when it comes to the natural world and birds and similar subjects, where it's totally possible to have artists have a fanciful or inaccurate version of birds that doesn't capture the ecological realities that misrepresents them, both potentially on a simplistic way in terms of accurately depicting certain field marks, but more seriously, that it risks simplifying or delivering a generic bird rather than one that is alive to all the complexity of these different species.
So a few questions to close on California history. This is the California History Podcast, and I would love for you to talk about what birds can teach us about a history of a place. There's the phrase the canary in the coal mine, as birds being an indicator of, as a bellwether for where things are going. Are we entering dangerous times? How would you connect birds and the history of a place if someone were to ask you to explicate that?
Yeah, it's an interesting question given my particular perspective and project. It is undoubtedly, absolutely true, the canary in a coal mine metaphor, that birds can often be a sign and warning of negative ecological trends, of harm and destructive patterns that are ongoing. We talked about how that might manifest in the case of oak trees, for instance, when they're lost from a landscape, that and you'll see that effect ripple across birds and other organisms. But I would also raise a little happier note and different perspective on this one, in that the birds that I focus on are often the most common and abundant species, and they are the birds in many cases that have thrived among people to some degree in this current book, Birds in the Oaks, but to an even greater degree in my previous book, The Private Lives of Public Birds, which dealt with neighborhood and backyard species, where for many of them, they have become more abundant and widespread with the spread of urbanization. Things like Anna's hummingbird or hooded oriole, or northern mockingbird formerly were either not present in the northern half of California or were present only in the summer. And now those birds are. They have broader ranges, large populations due to the spread of, say, ornamental plants, or in some cases, certain agricultural practices. And that's true as well. It obviously doesn't erase larger patterns of ecological damage, but I think it's good to be grateful when things do work out in a way that has, on a local and individual level, a positive impact. That we can be grateful that we have hummingbirds and mockingbirds and hooded orioles. The spread of those species does not seem to be ecologically destructive in itself. But the story of birds and people is one that has evolved over the centuries, and my primary emphasis is always on appreciating the world that we have been given.
That's a wonderful perspective because I do feel I do there's a deep conservative romanticism to a lot of nature writing that sees times in the past where that's when we had real nature as opposed to now, as a and not seeing our inclusion in the space as part of what nature is. And as you say, and as the great philosopher of American society, Jeff Goldblum, said, nature will find a way. I want to ask you not to go back to doom and gloom again, but we just had some devastating fires in Southern California recently. And I was curious, what can we do to protect landscape for birds? Or do you think in those terms? How do you think about like environment ensuring that the environment is equitable for all the participants? Or is that too like control, like we're trying to control the direction of nature? How do you think about these concepts?
It's a little bit beyond my area of specialty. Obviously, in many respects, habitat loss is the biggest threat to many bird species, whether that be to natural disasters, to climate change, to urbanization, to other landscape transformations for human purposes. And in many senses, it's well known what would reverse that would be preservation of wild lands and reducing human encroachments, so trying to contain our development within more narrow bounds. I don't think there's, in many cases, a mystery about that end goal, but finding the balance between competing interests is always the challenging part for any society.
We close these podcasts every time with book recommendations. We already talked about books a little bit at the front. Is there any others you'd like to include? Great books, maybe some of those books that you described from the 1890s. What's a quote antique ornithology book that you'd recommend for people?
Yeah, I've got certainly one stands preeminent in my mind, which is William Lyon Dawson's 1923 Birds of California, which in its original form is this magisterial 4-volume, 2,000-page encyclopedia of every bird in California. And he really captures that kind of old-fashioned version of ornithology that I was describing, where he's clearly a man who knows an incredible amount about birds. But he also writes in ways that are not afraid to show human bias, to show humor, to show enthusiasm, to show affection, to admire a beautiful song, or to mock a bird's less noble behaviors. And so it's very hard to find now, but there was some years
I'm
ago.
sure it's out of print. Yeah,
For some reason, no one's
unfortunately.
wanted to publish, republish the 2,000-page
On, why not?
1923
Sure, the
ornithology.
economics of that are great.
There was a much abridged paperback published a few years ago by Heyday Books under the title Dawson's Avian Kingdom. So I would recommend looking that up. Might be easier to find. And one other one in the same vein, touchstone for trees, would be Donald Kullross Peattie's A Natural History of Western Trees. That one, I think, is a little later. I think it was 1950. But it is a similar thing where it's essentially my approach of taking a species by species look at the trees in this case of the West, and integrating the scientific understanding of their time with a personal perspective that can be sometimes humorous, often poetic, often lyrical, and above all focused on appreciation.
Do you just pick a random spot and explore? Do you read these kind of in order? Like, how do you consume these? I'm curious.
Yeah, they're certainly not books that one would sit down and read straight through. They're books for dipping into. And so for me, when I was, say, writing these essays, I always looked back to see what everyone has ever said about California Toeies, which is not an inexhaustible amount. It's a digestible literary legacy for a given bird like that. But yeah, you can just dip in, find a favorite species, and you will very often find some nuggets.
Yeah, I have some big collections of poetry, and I do the same thing with that. And you dip in, find some beauty, and then check out. And to close, Jack, what are you working on next?
So I've got a few vague projects in mind on the nature book front. Probably the net where I would like to go next is to make a similar volume of essays about trees of California.
Oh, please.
Yeah, that's my hope. I've been gathering material for some years, and hopefully that'll coalesce into a finished product. And then on a totally different track, I've recently been spending a lot of time at UC Davis, where my wife is studying. And I have entered into the study of ancient Greek. And I've also been occupying myself with ancient Epicurean philosophy. And we'll see about the publication potential for that project. But I'd like to make a more modern and lyrical rather than scholarly translation of some underappreciated ancient philosophical texts.
That sounds wonderful. I love dipping in that. I took a lot of Greek and Latin, was half a classics major, and I just love sitting down with a giant, in particular Cicero, just sitting down with Cicero and trying to unpack those sentences. That's the greatest intellectual joy I probably ever experienced. Yes, continue, please. So again, the two books are, and I would recommend them both. They're wonderful. You've written more books, but I'm going to mention specifically Private Lives of Public Birds in the Oaks. Fantastic books to look at the life of birds. So lyrical, so beautiful. Thank you, Jack, for writing them and spending time with me today.
Thank you, Jordan. This was great.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us by either giving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time. ¶¶